Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 2:44 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is October 1st, and it's Friday, so it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off and have a look at the ARK Innovation ETF, because it did really spectacularly well in 2020. And that really strong performance peaked at the beginning of this year. And that was a very significant advance, going from 40 to 160, so a four-time advance in the space of less than 12 months is really quite impressive for any kind of investment. And subsequently, it has pulled back in a violent manner, but found support around the $100 area and rebounded. But primarily, it's been ranging in the course of the last 6 months. So now we're coming down towards the lower side of that range again. Now, when we look at what's going on in the wider world and we think about everything that is relevant today, what might be relevant in future, and what's been said over the last few years, well, then we have to marry that up with what exactly is going on in the markets. So how much of it is really supported by what's going on in the price action. So, for example, we can look at the ARK Innovation ETF, and it has broken below the trend mean, and it's been going sideways after a steep decline for 6 months. So that begs the question, is this a consolidation or is it a peak? And a peak of not just short-term significance or indeed medium-term significance, but is this bull trend over? Now, Cathie Wood was being interviewed. I saw her quoted in a significant number of articles over the course of the last week. And she's certainly being looked to as one of the titans of the financial sphere. So her firm has done incredibly well in attracting assets and becoming media spotlights. And she has no qualms about quoting some really quite compelling statistics. So some of those statistics are that when the doubling of sales in electric vehicles occurs, then the cost of the battery goes down by 28%. And that means that that will contribute to the cost of an electric vehicle dropping by about 15% every time there's a doubling in sales. So we know that all of the automotive companies have got plans for building out their fleets and their sales of electric vehicles. So then it's reasonable to assume that over the course of the next 5 years that the sales of electric vehicles will increase meaningfully. And with economies of scale, then it's quite possible that we're going to see them become much more price competitive with internal combustion engines. So that's certainly beneficial from the perspective of the argument for why there should be electric vehicles. And then, of course, there are the other kinds of statistics, like that the original sequencing of the human genome was 2.7 billion, now it's down to about $500. But if one had actually been looking at the pace with which it has been contracting, it should be at $100 by now. So, in fact, the pace of innovation has been slowing down. And then when we think about the promises in healthcare, well, one thing that we've seen over the course of just today was that Merck's pill for treating the coronavirus has been approved, and it is effective in reducing the chances of mortality by 50%. So the share popped on the upside in here today, and wasn't quite able to hold all of the advance, but one thing that it certainly did was that it weighed on Moderna. So Moderna pulled back in a rather profound manner, so that's suggesting at least a peak of near-term significance, One of the challenges with investing in biotech is that some of the companies have done so very well in the course of the last year that they now dominate these indices in terms of their market cap. So then the biotech ETF also pulled back in a violent manner in here this week because of this type of winner takes all mentality, which isn't really conducive to investing in an ETF. And in fact, it had a wider ranging effect as well, because the IPO ETF also has a heavy weighting in Moderna, 9%. It's its largest weighting. And that also then had a knock-on effect in terms of enthusiasm for the IPO ETF. And it's now also back in the region of the trend mean. The one thing that I think is interesting about this ETF is that it's supposed to invest in IPOs, but its second largest weighting is Uber. And Uber is many things, but it IPO'd 3 years ago. So if we're thinking about what the IPO ETF actually represents, it's an actively managed portfolio of newly issued companies rather than simply a collection of, or an equal weighted collection of IPO stocks. So it's perhaps not the best reflection of how the IPO sector is in fact doing. It is interesting, however, that companies like Uber are bouncing from the region of their IPO level. And following last week's bounce, it did follow through on the upside in here this week. There is the potential, at least, that they are on the cusp of profitability. Now, one thing that I think is particularly relevant for the wider technology sector, it's that companies like Uber and Lyft succeeded because they were able to successfully circumvent regulation. There were clear laws in place about taxi medallions, what they costed, how many of them there could be, and then ride-hailing came in and swept it all away because they moved so quickly that regulation didn't keep up and they eviscerated the taxi sector and through economies of scale were able to build businesses globally in a very quick amount of time. Now, that has allowed them to then gain a foothold and create international businesses, which are basically taxi services and with a bit of technology thrown in on the side. And Lyft is also continuing to do well, and it reached profitability quicker than Uber did. But then what we have is a clear example of companies that moved quickly to circumvent regulation, and that allowed them to gain market share and establish themselves in what is effectively a new business. And arguably, Airbnb has done the same thing, that by moving quickly and circumventing hotel occupancy rules and short-term rental rules, then the company has succeeded in establishing itself as one of the biggest sellers of rooms around. And the share is continuing to firm from the region of its IPO level. And this is also particularly relevant for Bitcoin, because we can then go and think about what happened in China. So what happened with Lyft and Uber and Airbnb? Well, those might be considered to be benign examples. Now we have Alibaba. So Alibaba set up an e-commerce site, and it started off as wholesale, allowing factories to find customers, then retail, and then they went ahead and formed this e-commerce solution, then e-financial solution. So the online payments that we that Tencent and then Alibaba pioneered, this has been something that came directly up against banking regulation, So they were essentially offering money market funds, and they were offering much more competitive deposit rates than were allowed by banks or allowed to banks. That allowed them to accumulate massive deposits. And then they, well, that allowed, that was possible because they circumvented regulation. Well, then, of course, they've come up against a wall of regulation because it looked like they were starting to challenge the communist administration. So Alibaba is now back below the $150 area. There's been a lot of institutional interest in buying the dip in Alibaba, and it is still, there isn't a great deal of evidence to support the view that this low is in fact in, despite the fact that we have this rebound occurring right now in Wall Street and with the prospect of additional liquidity provision in China. But I think it's particularly relevant to think about these types of examples when we then come and think about Bitcoin, because Bitcoin's also moving fast and loose. And the innovation that we're seeing in the cryptocurrencies sector, whether it's with stable coins, and I think Jay Powell was quite clear in stating over this week that he views them as akin to money markets and that they should attract the same kind of regulation as money markets, as money market funds. And then you have the chairman of the SEC talking about cryptocurrencies as being securities, which would imply that they would attract the same kind of regulation as securities. But if those two things go ahead, well, then it will lend legitimacy to the sector. So that's a good reason for why the price is firming today. But most particularly, it would thin out the herd because there are lots of projects. There are over 6,000 tokens, and that does not include all of the non-fungible tokens that have been set up over the course of the last year. So there are thousands and thousands of tokens, most of them not fit for purpose, most of them where no work is taking place, and they have been created as vehicles for speculation and for basically trying to part fools from their money. And that is something that will eventually be regulated, but it will also mean that there will be further concentration within the sector. So that looks like it's beneficial for the larger tokens. So we've had a significant rebound from the region of the trend mean today from the Bitcoin price. It's the same thing for Ethereum. It bounced pretty emphatically from the region of the trend mean as well. When we then go a little bit further down the line in terms of popularity, then we've also seen at least some evidence of support in the region of the trend mean from Ripple as well. So this, I think, is relevant that these types of instrument have moved fast and they've been able to avoid regulation so far. And the way things are going, it looks like they've been able to carve out a sufficiently large market for themselves that they will eventually survive and be able to prosper within that niche. Quite whether they will ever grow to a position where they can threaten the established financial network remains very much to be seen, but it does mean that some of the more egregious trading strategies that have taken place will gradually be taken out of the market. It should contribute to less volatility. Of course, one of the reasons why people like to trade cryptocurrencies is because of the volatility. So then there's that's almost a good news, bad news story. But what I find particularly interesting is that at least Bitcoin is firming. Whereas when we look at some of those innovation stories and the really compelling statistics that are quoted about them, well, they're not firing on the upside. And it would suggest that a lot of the good news has already been priced in. Now, we can also then think about the performance of shares like Tesla. So, and sorry, didn't type the ticker correctly. Tesla shares have been advancing over the course of the last 6 months. It's now back in the region of the $800 area, and sales of its cars are also improving. But in order to justify the valuation, well, and let's just take a look at what that is. Well, with an estimated PE of 146, it's come in substantially because the PE used to be substantially higher than that. So the company is delivering on its earnings. Of course, it's still trading at a price to sales ratio of around 17, but when we look at that PE ratio, well, and on an historic basis, it used to be north of 3,000, so coming into only 400, that's almost 10 times better than it used to be, and yet it's still at nosebleed levels. But at least the company is making money and selling cars, so that at least is in its favor. But of course, everyone is really looking at the, I guess, the progress that they're making in artificial intelligence. And this was another one of the statistics that Cathie Wood had to quote, was that the training costs for artificial intelligence are dropping by 68% per year. So Tesla is deploying supercomputers to try and solve this problem. And eventually, we're going to have an innovation. I'm not entirely sure that this is a brute force type of solution. And there is so much data, and it's just going to require a step change in how data is appreciated. And whichever company can come up with that first is going to capture a very significant prize. So we continue to be in an environment which, where there is significant potential for technological innovation. But we also have to remind ourselves that technological innovation does not come for free, and it requires significant long-term investments in unprofitable businesses until eventually the investments start to pay out and profits start to come through. So over the course of the last decade, where we've had extraordinarily low interest rates and abundant liquidity, well, then there has been a huge amount of money poured into various ventures. So we now have reusable rockets, and we have a commercial space industry where one never existed before, and in fact, no one really thought it was possible before. We have the ability to create vaccines almost instantly. Now, our permitting process and the trials process is still going to take time, but it is worth reminding ourselves that Moderna got the genetic imprint of the coronavirus, and they had their first vaccine candidate within 3 days, whereas previously the fastest would have been 3 years. So there has been an incredible advance in the pace of innovation. But as I said, it doesn't come free. So therefore, the growth sector and the realm of the possible and the realm of the impossible sector, well, then that is extremely interest rate dependent. And over the course of the last week, we've had a meaningful pop on the upside in terms of the 5-year yield. And the 5-year yield's important because it is analogous to the duration of the 5-year of the USA's debt. So the average maturity of US debt is around 5 years. For Germany, it's around 7.8 years. For Australia, it's around the same. But for the UK, it's more like 14 years. So we can then think about, well, which governments have the most leeway in terms of how they manage their finances? Well, with an average duration of 14 years, the UK has been issuing a lot of longer dated debt, so they have plenty of time in which to manage their finances. And I think that's less appreciated by investors, or indeed by currency investors. Whereas when we think about the USA, there's this massive quantity of debt with an ongoing financing requirement. So when the yield popped above 1% earlier this year, we had a significant sell-off in the stock market. But now the yield is starting to come back down. So the reality is that if the yields break out, it really is a catch-22 situation. Then the threat is that there'll be a significant loopback in terms of the knock-on effect for the economy, and then that would be deflationary. So if it's deflationary, then yields should start to come back down. But of course, we're still in an inflationary time, and the US government is eager to agree on additional spending measures. Now, they are attempting at least to push through the infrastructure bill over the course of the next week. And quite whether the $3.5 trillion effort to remake the economy is withering on the branch remains to be seen, but it isn't looking particularly enthusiastic right now. So with the prospect of less supply, then the yield is starting to come back down, and that's helping to support the stock market. So the S&P 500 was up in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today, rebounding from the recent lows, up about 1%. So we've had a 5% pullback, which is really nothing in the scale of the wider market environment. It's just that it's the largest pullback we've seen in a year. So then that's an inconsistency, and it suggests that we're back into a period of mean reversion, but yet there is still potential for additional upside here because we're seeing yields come back down. We're moving back from a risk-off environment to a risk-on environment, and certainly the Merck announcement is aiding and abetting that. But we are still very much plagued by these supply disruptions. So in many respects, we are back in a supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment. And it's just not the same kind of environment that we had back in the early 2000s, because back then, the supply inelasticity had been driven by decades of underinvestment in supply of both industrial resources, of oil, and then agriculture as well. Then we had the demand driver, which was China's accession to the WTO. So that was a billion people entering the global economy, and the industrialization of a major economy, which then went on to become the second largest economy in the world. So that kind of massive demand driver, coupled with an inability to increase supply, contributed to a decade-long bull market in all manner of commodities, and it was led higher by oil. So now we're in a different situation. We are still in a, or at least we're back in a supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment. But the sources of those two factors are different. So on the one hand, we have an increase in demand, and the increase in demand is driven primarily by the breakdown in just-in-time manufacturing. So we've had decades of globalization, and we've had decades where interest rates were coming down. And what that encouraged companies to do was to offshore. And because they had visibility on what their earnings were going to be, they had visibility on what sales might be likely to be, and then they had visibility on their labor costs, transportation costs, commodity costs. Well, then they were able to structure a global supply chain that worked at very high efficiency but low capacity for infraction. Well, the introduction of the pandemic into that calculus has changed everything, because on the one hand, a lot of companies went into the pandemic with reasonably low inventories because they had no reason to expect that they would need inventory. Then, because of the pandemic, companies started to shut down, and in a piecemeal manner, we started to see disruptions in the supply chain because companies simply could not get the parts and equipment they required, and they were in no way prepared for the environment where that was going to be a headache. At exactly the same time, because so many people were forced to work from home, there was a massive increase in demand for everything, whether that was because of panic buying, or because of people moving house, or retrofitting their existing homes to allow multiple people to work from home simultaneously. So that contributed to a lot of disruption. Now, in conference calls in the third and fourth quarters of 2020, we had one CEO after another talking about resilience. And there is at least some movement towards creating more resilient supply chains. And that in particular is favoring countries like India, Vietnam, Indonesia, and Mexico. So the Nifty index has continued to rally. Now, it is overbought in the short term. So, and India is a volatile market, so it is quite likely we're going to get at least some consolidation. But if India is going to be a beneficiary of supply chain migration, and then it's also a major supplier of young people willing to accept lower wages on a comparative basis relative to competing nations, then India is likely to be a country that does substantially better over the course of the next decade. Well, then we can think about when, if those supply chains do migrate, then we're going to move into a different kind of environment, because China was a one-stop shop for manufacturing, and it's going to remain a major manufacturing sector. But because of everything that's going on in China, and the willingness now of the administration there to embark upon a significant reorientation of the economy away from heavy manufacturing towards light manufacturing, or basically moving up the value chain and producing less products that are heavily dependent on pollution, most particularly steel and aluminium. Well, then that's going to have a significant knock-on effect for global supply chains. So it's also going to make them less efficient. And India is less likely to become a one-stop shop for manufacturing because it doesn't have nearly as much land and it has more people than China. So the population density is even greater in India than it is in China. And and it's also a democracy. So trampling on individuals' rights isn't nearly as easy in India as it is in China. And what that suggests is that there will be multiple competing areas that in the global supply chain. And it's also going to mean a lot more shipping. And shipping rates continue to march higher. The Baltic Dry Index has completed its base formation and continues to push on the upside. Demand for new ships is back at where it was in 2007. Prices are up substantially from where they were in 2020. They are still a fraction of where they were back in 2006 and 7 and 8, but those were peak values, and it looks quite likely that we are going to go back to those peak values and potentially exceed them, because the cost of shipping has also increased, So companies, they're profitable right now, but they've also experienced margin compression, and not least because of compliance with the IMO 2020 regulations. And compliance costs are rising everywhere, and that's adding to inflationary pressures. So carbon futures continue to march higher. Now, they were off their highs in here this week, but it's the stated political objective to get carbon prices up to about 100 euros, which is an additional 40% from where we are right now. And that is considered to be the hurdle level over above which investments in hydrogen will become profitable. And they're using the same kinds of economies of scale arguments for hydrogen as were used a decade ago and even today for batteries. But the one thing that I found, I saw this graphic earlier on this week, which I found to be quite interesting, and it is the UK's energy mix. So we can see that natural gas has been up and down, but really fairly holding around the 40% level. And its coal has almost completely disappeared. And in coal's place, wind has taken most of the market share. So the UK substituted wind for coal, but that was intermittent supply for base load supply, and that left it really very susceptible to significant disruption. So then that also has contributed to this incredible advance in natural gas prices. Now we know that acceleration is a trend ending, and this kind of acceleration cannot last indefinitely. But at the same time, we don't really have much evidence to suggest that it is yet over. And we're going to have to see a supply response in order to really start to bring these prices back down again. But the reality is that because of this phenomenal advance, it has alerted investors to the additional risk premium that has to be attached to intermittent sources of electricity. So it's very unlikely that prices are going to come back down below the 50 area where they had often traded prior to this big advance. And we're in a new price structure overall. We can also then think about this phenomenal advance in Newcastle coal, and it's on a similar trajectory to the UK natural gas price. So this has been a very significant change. And we can also see here that today Newcastle coal had this massive downside key reversal. So accelerations like this do not last indefinitely, and this is suggestive at least of a contract change and potentially that the supply is starting to, or demand is starting to be eroded following extraordinary moves on the upside. Can also think about this contract table that it's a year in advance, so there aren't any near-term contracts that need to change. So we've had this incredible change overall, and quite likely a move over in terms of the commodity contract. Now the big question is, are we going to see an additional decline in here over the course of the next couple of weeks? So when we look at these prices, natural gas surging, coal surging, it's exposing the fragility of the energy sector. And that's also contributing to additional interest in the oil market. So oil prices are right in the region of $80, and That's economic for the vast majority of producers. But because we're seeing this panicky environment for natural gas and coal, and then also for gasoline in the UK, then it's putting upward pressure on oil because investors are starting to wonder about the security of the energy sector. And it's also contributing to additional upside for companies like Royal Dutch Shell, which was able to break up and out of its range in here this week. So that looks like a completed type 2 bottom. Of course, the big challenge for the energy sector and the large energy companies are the oil majors control about 10% of global supply, and they are being assailed on all sides by activist investors and attempting to stop them from investing in additional new supply. So that's also contributing to less supply being available in the short term. It's also giving more power to OPEC, who are in no way beholden to activist investors. So the state-owned oil companies will continue to pump as much as they can, and the established oil companies will be under greater pressure to be more environmentally aware. But the reality is that we're not going to be getting rid of dependence on oil or fossil fuels anytime soon. And the efforts underway to adopt a zero carbon emission environment are ultimately going to be extraordinarily difficult to achieve. It's going to require spending on a level that is just truly extraordinary. And you're then depending on the established energy sector to spend that money while also eroding their ability to make money. And that's not a sustainable business model. So then the big question is how much of this enthusiasm about zero carbon emissions and environmental solutions is about the big climate conference in the UK next, or well, this month, and will it all be forgotten afterwards? Because we've definitely seen that the enthusiasm for passing the big environmental protection portion of the stimulus package in the UK, in the USA, hasn't been greeted with a great deal of enthusiasm by the rest of the Democratic Party in the USA. So then the question is whether any of this additional legislation will in fact pass into law, and how enthused will governments be in actually securing it. From an investment perspective, for example, the Brookfield Renewable Energy Fund has been one of the better performers and has also been really quite attractive from the perspective of institutional or family office type investments, because they were able to pick up really choice solar assets when SunPower went bust, and if they pay a yield, so then and it's an attractive yield at 3.3%. But the challenge is that a lot of the solar sector is extremely interest rate dependent, so it's quite likely that the sector should bounce if yields start to come back down again. But then the question has to be addressed: what exactly are central banks going to do? Because they're talking about the need to taper, and they're talking about raising interest rates. But we have this environment where governments are just in no way prepared to make the fiscal sacrifices necessary to fund the debt burden. So that greatly inhibits the potential to raise interest rates. And what I found interesting was when the Federal Reserve estimated that their interest rate would be around 1.6% in 3 years. Well, let's just then look at that 3-year yield. Because rather than thinking that it will be at 1.6% in 3 years, perhaps another way of thinking about it would be that that's the terminal value that they reach in this entire cycle, that interest rates will not get above 1.6% in this entire cycle, that what we are in fact in is a debt trap, and that there's just simply no way that central banks are going to be able to raise interest rates. And that's particularly true of places like the USA because of the short duration of the debt. Well, if that is indeed the case, then we're occasionally going to have pops on the upside in the yield, and stock markets will pull back, and particularly the growth sector will pull back. And one thing that I think is also relevant is that the 7 largest companies in the world, or at least on Wall Street to be more accurate, they've lost their outperformance. So they outperformed the NYSE all the way from 2013 until the middle of 2020. And since then, it's rolled over. And then we can just simply zoom in and look at companies like Amazon, where the price has been going sideways now for a year. And it is just about holding on to the region of its trend mean. We can then think about companies like Disney, which have also done spectacularly well during the pandemic and is right in the region of its trend mean as well. So it is absolutely necessary that yields start to come back down if these bounces from the lower side of their respective ranges are going to hold. And then we can think about where the risks are. The Russell 2000 has gone nowhere for most of the last year. And this kind of loss of momentum following a vertical move higher, this is looking risky. So we've had a really phenomenal advance in US assets, and the dollar has been quite firm of late, and it popped on the upside with yields and risk appetite disappearing earlier this week, and now it's starting to come back down. But gold prices do look like they're starting to turn the corner. We had a meaningful move higher yesterday. We've had a little bit of follow-through in here today. It hasn't quite yet broken the sequence of lower rally highs from the early September peak, and it will certainly need to hold the lows around the $1,700 area. So, and this just looks like a consolidation in the region of the all-time peak around 2011. Now, obviously, in 2011, the price also accelerated up to the peak, and then it went sideways for about a year, and then it broke downwards. So, obviously, that's the last thing we want to see is a downward break. But I just don't believe that that's what's going to happen. I think it's much more likely that we're going to have additional interest flowing into the gold market, because there have been plenty of instances over the course of the last 2 years where both equities and bonds pulled back together. And that puts a hole in the rationale for investing on a 60-40 basis, or part equities, part bonds. It also puts a great deal of stress on risk parity, which is one of the most popular and successful of the hedge fund models. And therefore, it should encourage investors to look at alternative hedging opportunities. So, obviously, some people think that Bitcoin is one of those, and the share, or the, well, the asset price is bouncing right now. And gold is also an alternative. Silver prices had pulled back rather sharply earlier on this week because of solar panel production in China getting taken offline because of the lack of power. But silver has now started to bounce, and it's back above that psychological $22 level, but it needs to break the sequence of lower rally highs to confirm more than a short-term low. And gold shares are right back in the region of the $30 area and had dropped below it earlier this week. If gold can muster support, then we'll likely see that gold shares will resume a position of high beta plays relative to the gold price. They're making money hand over fist right now. And obviously, they're taking some flak from the rising cost of oil because oil is a significant cost in the production of just about all commodities. So that's a significant factor for gold miners and miners everywhere. We've had significant volatility in the iron ore price. So I think this really does help to ram home the point that this new supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment is much more about copper than it is about iron ore and oil. And it's more about investments in renewable energy and the reorientation of the energy sector. And then we have the debt question. So then that is going to be an increasingly important point. We have extraordinary valuations on Wall Street, and we have this the success of the big companies and their ability to outperform has disappeared over the course of the last year. And the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index is still holding the sequence of higher reaction lows, and it is right in the region of the trend mean. But we can look at some of the constituents of that index, and they're just about holding on. So we had a downside key reversal from Microchip Technologies in here this week. It looks, yes, it does, that is a new high. So this is a downside key reversal. Micron Technology pulled back rather sharply earlier this week as well because of oversupply in their particular segment of the market. So it's now trading back below the trend mean. Both Microchip Technology and Lam Research are among the suppliers of machinery to the producers of chips. So if they're losing momentum, it would suggest that the demand cycle is starting to moderate. We've also started to see that Taiwan Semiconductor has lost a lot of momentum. So we're definitely seeing a transition occur within the technology sector, and they're not firing on the upside. Whereas we are starting to see that some of the payments companies are doing better, and banks are doing better, and insurance companies are doing better because they're liquidity providers, and we're in a liquidity-rich environment. But the big growth in the last decade has been technology. And if we're moving into more of an inflationary-oriented economy, then it's companies with pricing power are those that do best. Well, software companies have pricing power, and those that have adopted a subscription business model, they continue to have pricing power. And most particularly only to the extent that they are selling truly essential products. Whereas then we can think about the commodities, and commodity prices are trending higher. And this is a medium-term consideration. The Invesco Agriculture Fund is based on futures, so the times when it trends higher generally are supported by backwardations. And when you have an uptrend that's supported by backwardations, well, then that's generally a supply inelasticity argument. So we're definitely seeing additional interest in things like wheat and the price is now bouncing from the region of the trend mean. And we can see that coffee is also starting to steady once more. So it's also suggestive of the fact that there has been significant damage done to the production capacity of Brazil following the frost earlier on in, what was it, about 2 months ago. Palm oil prices have also broken on the upside, so we're at new all-time highs. Cotton prices surged in here this week on the back of additional demand coming through from China. So they're stockpiling. And then we've also had a significant move in cotton prices, which has completed its base formation. Now, obviously, we've had these extremely sharp moves, and we have short-term overbought conditions, so we may yet get some consolidation. And if bond yields start to come back down, well, then that's going to remove at least some of the panicky environment about the inflationary pressures. But nonetheless, it's inflation over the medium term. And if we just go back and think about the supply inelasticity means rising demand, well, the rising demand factor is driven by liquidity, and it's driven by economic growth and the rise of the middle class. But this rise of the middle class is primarily about innovation and cooperation outside of China. So the emerging markets ex-China ETF continues to outperform. But we're also at the trough of the credit cycle in China. So that would suggest that the incredible pressure that's coming to bear on companies like China Evergrande and the significant scope for contagion and the size of the problem is almost impossible to quantify, because nobody knows for sure just how big the company's off-balance sheet liabilities are and how much difficulty they're going to have in untangling those and how much additional pressure that will put on other issuers of debt. And we can definitely think about the fact that there's been a significant downtrend in high-yield Asian debt, so it's continuing to move lower, and we're well into double-digit yields for high-yield debt in Asia. Well, that suggests that China is going to be stimulating because they just don't have a choice. The size of local government debt in China is half of GDP, so we're talking trillions of dollars worth of debt. And there is just no way that that is going to get paid back until they start to introduce property taxes. And that's going to be extraordinarily disruptive, because it would greatly increase the cost of holding property. And it would potentially result in a liquidation process for some properties that aren't worth what they were paid for. So in order to avoid that kind of disruption, considering all of the additional challenges that they have right now, ranging from the pandemic to the electricity shortages that have been implemented as a result of adopting on a wholesale manner the need to decarbonize without in fact putting the alternatives in place first, and then the desire to clean up the air ahead of the Winter Olympics. All of these factors are contributing to difficulties for the Chinese administration, and the easy thing to do would be to increase liquidity. So they may not increase it to the same extent that they did back in 2008, but they certainly need to stimulate, because they're looking down the barrel of a massive recession. And that suggests that we're still in a benign liquidity environment. And as long as we're still in a benign liquidity environment, then stock market trends are likely to move up and to the right. And It's not until we see meaningful changes in terms of reducing the availability of cash and raising interest rates that we need to significantly worry. And I just don't think that the pace of tapering that central banks are talking about right now is achievable. Eventually, they'll have to. And eventually, we'll get back to economies that are ready for interest rate hikes. But we're only at the cusp, really, of starting to reopen. And certainly, the Merck news will help to support the reopening argument. And there's certainly the potential for the reopening portion of the market to do substantially better from here. But ultimately, if we get rising interest rates and the removal of liquidity, it's going to necessitate a significant reorientation of interest and exposure within portfolios, and most particularly to the high growth and technology sectors. Regardless of the arguments about innovation, that innovation doesn't come for free. And we just don't have the rationale in terms of performance to justify it, particularly as commodities start to break out of their basis and we start to see relative performance picking up from both energy and commodities. And we start to see emerging markets that are improving in terms of their balance of payments, improving in terms of their economic activity. And they are the ones that do better in a an environment of rising interest rates. So the big linchpin then remains the dollar. And the dollar has been very firm over the course of the last 3 months. And it's still holding the region of the trend mean. But eventually, it's going to break lower. It's really only a question of how long that takes. And when that happens, there'll be a massive reorientation away from growth and towards value. And the value segment has started to outperform over the course of this week, and it's still in the region of its lows overall. And this looks like a relative base formation. Eventually, value will start to outperform growth, but not until interest rates start to rise. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.